Hello, and welcome to Endeavors.
Not beneath, starry, held the curtain when he cried, and when he fell, you made a mess. Though I told you what was best, you shouldn't have looked this way. We should have been late that day. I shouldn't have trusted the look in his eyes. Freddy fell, it's all gone to hell. Now I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. Freddy fell, it's all gone to hell. Now she's crying evil. When will my eyes dry?
Eyes are closed, cheeks are wet. You're comforting. And when I spill over your bed, I told you all the lies that I've been fed. Oh, I shouldn't have looked his way. We should have been late that day. I shouldn't have trusted. Shoot a drop. Freddy fell, it's all gone to hell. Now she's crying, Isabel. When will my eyes dry?
Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. I got a notification today from LinkedIn that congratulated me on 8 years at Endeavors Radio. So it was 8 years ago that I first went on the air at CJSF Radio at SFU in Vancouver in February of 2010, believe it or not. This also happens to be, at least in the current iTunes feed, episode 100. Now, this may be episode 100, a sort of the podcast version of Endeavors, but like I said, I've been doing it for 8 years, so I've calculated that I've probably done about 450 episodes or so, give or take. But no, I'm really, really excited about this episode. I'm sort of titling it the old and the new, because I have the man who was Toronto's first poet laureate, and probably a man who many consider to be the national poet of Canada, or at least our Father Goose, Canada's grandfather in terms of poetry, Dennis Lee. And he'll be on to talk about his new collection, and he's been writing now for over 50 years. On the other end of the spectrum, my music guests today are two young women who are just 15 years old, and they've already recorded an album and a music video and have played at the legendary Horseshoe Tavern. They are Bridget Fry and Pascal Padilla, and they make up Moscow Apartment. And you'll be hearing a couple of songs from their EP as well. And, you know, a lot of bands give me CDs, and because of the way Apple decides to structure their stuff, my AirBook doesn't actually have a CD player, so I finally bit the bullet and am getting one off of Amazon, and luckily I still have some money left on my Amazon gift card that doesn't actually cost me anything. So I'll still be able to play the songs, just not necessarily quite as I intended them to, and maybe not quite CD quality, but they'll still be there nonetheless. I meant to have this up a little bit earlier, but we had a film crew in here earlier today at the house, the second in 2 weeks, actually. Our people seem to like our front porch and front door, so I had to sort of not to make much noise and just be around for that. So that's why it's a little bit late going up today, but here it is. My first guest is known as Father Goose, maybe you might know him as. He was Toronto's first poet laureate, and many consider him to be Canada's national poet. Of course, he's best known as a children's writer, writing, you know, rhymes such as Alligator Pie, Garbage Delight, Jelly Belly, Lizzie's Lion, Bubblegum Delicious. But he's also written other, you know, more adult-centric work, Kingdom of Absence, Civil Elegies, and Civil Elegies, now the Governor General's Award in 1972. He's also written prose. One of his most famous ones is, of course, Savage Fields, an essay in literature and cosmology of verse, The University Game, T.O., now the Young Toronto Poets. He's also the founder of Anansi Press, which he founded in 1967. Needless to say, he's been doing a lot of work for a great many years. His new collection is Good Night, Good Night. The poems in here have all been published before, but this gathers them together, and they all share a common theme of bedtime. He is Dennis Lee, and I spoke with him over the weekend prior to his appearance at Queen Books, a meet and greet with young fans here in Toronto. This is my conversation with Dennis Lee.
Dennis Lee, hello, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So you have a new collection out, Good Night, Good Night.
Good Night, Good Night.
And I know that this is sort of about bedtime and dreams. What, in particular for you, is intriguing or interesting about that part of life that we all go through, but we often don't have many memories of?
Yeah. Well, these are children's poems, as you know, and they're selected from a variety of my books over the years. So the publisher thought we could do a really super thing, as you say, honing in on that time between awake and asleep when you're drifting. And I loved the idea. And I must say also, the artist, Chin Lang, really caught that sense of a kind of magical time. But the challenge here, since the poems were already written, was as much in the editing and finding the six or seven poems that make up the board book, getting them in the right order to have that sense of deepening. Sort of mystery. It's a funny thing, isn't it? When we're no longer fully conscious, but we're conscious enough that we know we're not fully conscious. It's that in-between liminal state where the sense of, if we're lucky, of great physical comfort and also that anything could happen. Our mind, our feelings, our heart could drift to any place. That sense of great possibility is what thrills me about it.
Speaking of consciousness, I feel like we're in an age where not only with children, but in general, people zone out and their attention spans are shorter thanks to technology, phones, computers, screens, and all that. And as someone who is known for writing for children, how do you combat that? How do you say put down the screen and pick up a book?
Well, you know, Dan, it's a good question, and I think the only honest answer is I don't try to do that because I hope some of what I write would have that effect of slowing things down and giving, especially with children's poetry, a lot of it is going to be read by adults to their children or to kids at school or a library. But really all I can do is go as far into what the words want to be as I possibly can. And in the area you're talking about, the attention deficit, short order, quick satisfaction world that we more and more live in, if I can cast a spell with the words, or I can't cast the spell myself, but if the words agree to cast the spell themselves, then for some children, for some adults, it may have that effect of lengthening out the period of attentiveness. But, you know, if you try to attack that directly, frontally, you probably... It'll be words that have designs on the reader or the listener that are not free to pursue their own integrity of what it is they're trying to be. So that's one. It's sort of like setting out to be happy. Everybody who knows anything about it says, forget about trying to be happy because that's the one thing that's going to guarantee you'll never be happy. You know, you'll always be comparing how you are with some theoretical ideal of happiness. And in the same way, I think trying to write stuff that will slow rhythms down for people and give them that will happen if you write well, I think, or it has a chance of happening. But if you make that your number one goal, I suspect you'll never reach it.
Does poetry help with that in terms that a lot of poems, especially yours, are short enough that we don't need to spend an hour or two with it? You know, we can spend 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there and come back to it, and that may help us develop some sort of rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, with my kids' stuff, of course, the majority of them are pretty short, but that's appropriate for fetal literature. If I'm kidding when I say that, but kids can start enjoying poetry very, very early. You know, a year and a half is, if you're bouncing a child on your lap, they won't know what half the words are, but they don't know what half the words in ordinary conversation are yet either. So, poetry and Mother Goose and A.A. Milne and so on are definitely there for very young children. But the poems can't go on too long. You know, that's just part of the function of being an 18-month-old or a 3-year-old. So, in a way, like a 2-minute poem for a real youngster is that's major. Like that's a heavy block of time, man. So it's not the same as for an adult. But you're making a good point that poetry that can cast a spell, establish its own music and its own heartfulness in a shortest period of time may have more of a a leg up, an entry point now than something that's going to take half an hour to get into.
I heard you say once that you had 8-year-old groupies, and you know, fantasy writers aside, people like Stephen King, George R.R. Martin, writers don't necessarily or aren't necessarily afforded the same sort of celebrity, you know, somebody like a film star or a musician. So how does it feel to not only have a fan group that passionate, but also that young? What is your approach when you meet some of these young readers in person?
Well, I have to say it is thrilling. In terms of my own writing, I just try to ignore all that because you got to pay attention to what the words want to do, not sit back and bask in whatever degree of profile you've gotten. But it is, I find it thrilling because for kids to be in love with reading, with the world that it's taking them into, with their memories of when they were 2 years younger, when they were just a little kid, but they really liked whatever, you know, maybe including maybe something of my own. That whole process is wonderful to see. And if something that I've written gets tangled up in that and they have lovely memories of reading Alligator Pie or Garbage Delight at bedtime with their parents and want to talk about it and can't quite believe that this guy in front of them, who looks older than they imagined he might, but even the idea that a living human being with two arms and two legs and two heads is standing here and actually wrote the stuff that, you know, is mythic in their mind, that takes a lot of assimilating. So that whole process, it's lovely to see. And as I said, I used to try just to ignore that because I thought it was going to get in the way of the new stuff that I haven't written yet, which is always my preoccupation. But then I thought, no, that's not quite right. I should be grateful for that and enjoy it, and then squeeze the sponge, you know, after a little bit. Don't get fixated on it and move on to the place where I've never written anything. Everything I do is for the first time, which is, to my mind, how I really have to approach writing. But to spend a bit of time just saying, you know, I'm lucky. There are people, and a number of them are children, who treasure things I've written. And that's very lucky. I'm glad of that.
You haven't written just for children, obviously. Your 1972 book, I think Civil Elegies, won the Governor General's. And you've been in this city your whole life, where it's undergone a lot of change and a lot of revolution. And I think we're starting to see a little bit of something happening now. Where do you think we are culturally, and how can words be used as a tool for that kind of change?
You're asking good questions. I'm not sure I can get a purchase on them with my limited brain box here. But I grew up in the 50s and 60s. Okay, and at that time, it was heretical to say what seemed obvious to some of us, that there was very little self-respect in Canadian imaginative work. That it often had to, or felt it had to pretend to be set somewhere else, that it would be an embarrassment to have a novel that was set in North Bay or Cabbage Town or Kitsilano or Halifax or whatever, that nobody else would accept it, and we ourselves would be ashamed because it was so obvious that everything Canadian was second or third or tenth rate. So there was a lot of urgency to saying, look, we come from here, this is who we are, it's only a part of who we are, but to be ashamed of your own roots and to feel that you're intrinsically mediocre just isn't acceptable. So then the big push was just to say, we we got to start from who and where we are and not be ashamed of it. And now, it's a funny thing, that's happened enough that younger people now starting to write or paint or make films or whatever, to a great extent, just take that for granted, you know. Why wouldn't you feel that, right? Alice Munro has won the Nobel Prize. Person after person has just made their mark and done super stuff, and it's part of our heritage now. So stuff that was so urgent when I was in my formative period and really maturity, as I say, is taken for granted now, and I think that's great. Through the same time, we've become more and more an outlier of the American Empire and lost a lot of autonomy here. But other things I don't have any answers to. But when I was 25, I thought I either had all the answers or had better find out what all the answers were. And now that I'm 78... I'm not as confident that I ever will have all the answers.
What is your opinion of where the Canlit community as a whole is at? It's, you know, things like the Governor General's in the Scotiabank, it's been criticized for being very Ontario or Eastern Canada centric, and then there's a lot of stuff that happened out west that sort of divided the literary community. Where do you think we are in terms of how the literature community represents itself, and do you see anything that it needs to do to maybe advance itself in any way?
You know, Dan, I'm not sure that I have anything of interest to say here. I think we'll just have to. If I had anything substantive to say, I would say it. But well, there are a couple of questions. One is, how do people go about writing the best stuff they possibly can? And that, to me, that's the most important question. But for one person, it'll mean burrowing into their own work and ignoring everything else. And for somebody else, it will include a lot of work on the infrastructure of the writing community. The public and the private, for them, will be really married to each other. But nobody else can tell writer X or writer Y, this is how you should approach it. This is what will be right for you. You've got to find that out for yourself. And then I often have to burrow in, and the work I do that's meant as a contribution to the larger whole is often kind of invisible. I'll work editorially, just pro bono with other writers. What should be done on a national level or do you have any ideas about that? What do you think?
I think it's tough because, you know, we're changing so rapidly. Like, you know, like, everyone reads ebooks now as opposed to hardcover. And so I think just us as a society are having a hard time keeping up, because not only is everything changing quickly, but everything's happening all at once too, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I think it's tough. I think it's going to be interesting to see where it goes in the future. I was fortunate in that when I went to school, I never had a school that, you know, tried to ban any books. But I know that you've been the target of censorship in the past, which seems slightly odd for a children's author. How do you deal with something like that? Just being like, We sort of like your book, but we don't think it's an appropriate message to be sending our kids.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, it hasn't happened to me very often. But when it does, I've almost been delighted, because it just seems so goofy. The best known case, I think, came with the little story poem of Lizzie's Lion, which is a freestanding book with illustrations by Marie Louise Gay. And it was banned, as far as I got to understand it, it remained a little bit opaque, but I think it was in Alberta, one school board, the library board, I'm not sure which, and somehow down in California, I don't know, because it hasn't been published in the States, but got banned there anyway. And I think in each case, what the people who wanted it banned revealed was that it was propaganda for cannibalism, which Lizzie's a little girl who has a lion in her bedroom, and one night a friendly but fierce lion who lives in the closet. One night a burglar comes in and is making off with her piggy bank when the lion wakes up and demolishes the rotten robber. So it's in a deflected way, it's about bullying and standing up to finding resources for resisting bullying. But the thing that delighted me was that the logic of it was clear, that if a batch of lions got together and actually read the book, it would put in their mind the terrible idea that eating human beings was all right. So there have been a few attempts to demand books of mine elsewhere, and I think they've all been resisted quite nobly by the... But my cases are, they're just oddball things, you know. They're much more serious examples of book banning. And I don't know, there probably are a few books that should be banned. And there's something glorifying sadism towards young children. I mean, I don't want to see that in a school library. But so many of the books that get banned are among the great ones, you know. It's just crazy.
You were Toronto's first poet laureate, but one could argue that you're sort of Canada's national poet, at least for children, anyway. Are you comfortable with that title and sort of your status in the pantheon of Canadian writers?
I guess I am. For me to keep going has a lot to do with not getting all caught up in that. You know, I say to myself, well, that's the other Dennis Lee. That's a guy that I met once or twice, but he's out there doing whatever he does. My job is to worry about the damn bloody stuff I wrote yesterday, where the first 10 words are okay, but then it just goes completely to rat shit. How am I going to make something out of this? The music is all wrong. And for that, whether I'm Canada's Father Goose or whether I'm won this or that award is completely irrelevant. You know, it's just me and the blank piece of paper and then the crummy but occasionally worthwhile words that I put on the paper. You know, and what am I going to do about that today? So the honors you get and the criticism you get and all that, they're worth paying some attention to, but only some.
Do you have any advice for aspiring young writers?
Yep, two things. First, read, read, read. And second, write, write, write. You know, ordinary, familiar advice, but if you're not crazy about reading, certain kinds of reading, you know, there may be all kinds of stuff that you just ignore and want nothing to do with, that's fine. But if you aren't just dragged into certain kinds of reading, you know, how the hell did this person do this? Look at that, I still haven't figured it out. It's so good and I don't know why it is. If that's not there for you, then maybe maybe you're not claimed by the crazy vocation of writing. And if you don't find that you have to keep coming back and putting words on the page or to music or whatever, then again, maybe you've been spared the dubious blessing of being a scribbler.
Well, I see you got a bunch of fans clamoring to see you, so we'll end it there. But Dennis Lee, thank you so much, man.
My pleasure.
That was my conversation with Dennis Lee. Now here is Moscow Apartment with Caroline. That was Moscow Apartment with the song Caroline, and that can be found off their debut self-titled EP, which is out now. Chosen as the Young Performers of the Year at the 2017 Canadian Folk Music Awards and Best Young Songwriters at the 2017 Toronto Independent Music Awards, Moscow Apartment is driven by a mixture of sweet harmonies and belted refrains, acoustic shimmer and electric crunch, and the clever wordplay of multi-instrumentalists and versatile vocalists Bridget Fry and Pascal Padilla. The heart of their work is songcraft, with a power and a heft beyond their years, but that still draws from the dreams and worries of youth. They've been friends for years after having first met as members of the Viva Youth Singers, Toronto Top Kids Choir, and they began Moscow Apartment early in 2017, taking their name from the caption beneath a picture of an old Muscovite outside a bleak building in a book of photographs. As Pascal says, something about that caught our eye. It seemed like a good name, a different name for the duo. They put together a collection of solid songs in short order and completed their first EP with the support of an array of local musicians and a fundraising campaign. It was released in September 29th, my birthday, at the Burdock in Toronto, and it's been a whirlwind ever since. It's funny, this interview actually came out of another interview that I did. A couple weeks ago, you remember, I had on Danielle Duval, And I went to see her at the Horseshoe Tavern. She was playing there as part of a night called The Class of 2018. And she was the second musician on that night. But the first musicians on that night were Brigitte and Pascal. And I really, really liked their vibe. And I got in touch with them after the show. And they were so gracious and agreed to come on the show. I love what it says on their Facebook page. Where it says what their interests are. It says, writing songs with an indie folk vibe. We like playing around with strange lyrics and rocking out on ukuleles. We love coming up with interesting harmonies and mocking mansplainers. That's definitely true, as they describe themselves as quirky, dreamy, feminist indie folk. And as we'll hear at the end of the show, their song, Annie, definitely... epitomizes that. So without further ado, this is my conversation with Brigitte Fry and Pascal Padilla of Moscow Apartment.
Brigitte and Pascal, hello, what's up today?
Hi,
nothing much. Just chilling, hanging out.
Surviving this weather that doesn't seem to be getting better.
Barely.
There was like 2 weeks where I thought it was gonna get nicer, but no such luck.
I hate the cold. Yeah. I'm sorry, Canada, but I hate it.
My friend in Vancouver posted on her Facebook, she's like, yeah, I'm sitting on my balcony and it's 11 degrees outside right now.
I wish
it was like that. I can't. I love it when the snow melts and everything is like melting. I feel like I'm deaf. I love it.
Oh,
no,
okay.
No, it's new life. New birth.
You guys aren't snow people?
Not really.
Not a snow person.
I like the first snow, and then the second one sucks, and they all just get worse from there.
I mean, my mom is, like, from Northern Ontario, but my dad is from the Philippines, so I feel very torn about snow. I like looking at it from inside, that's always nice.
Yeah, I like this. I like seeing it, but that's it.
Makes sense. Yeah, so I came across you guys at the Horseshoe Tavern a couple weeks ago.
Fun show.
That must have been special because, I mean, it's probably the most iconic venue in the country. I mean, at least in Toronto, but
yeah,
I mean,
no.
it's definitely in Canada, it's up there. How did that feel for you guys being in that atmosphere?
It was amazing.
It was so
really cool.
It was really cool. But, like, I feel like we never feel like this is crazy until after it's done.
Yeah.
Because, like, if we process it, then we'll get nervous.
On stage. So, yeah, we kind of flipped out a little bit after. But, yeah, I remember.
After we're like, this is so cool.
Yeah. Melissa, our bassist.
That's a weird day.
We just called it the Horseshoe. She was like, oh yeah, so where is the Horseshoe? And she was like, so it's weird because like there's already one called the Horseshoe Tavern. And we're like, no, we're playing at the Horseshoe Tavern. And she like freaked out.
She
didn't believe us.
A copycat venue called the Horseshoe.
She thought we were joking about playing there, so it was really cool.
You guys had a couple of your friends, your backup band, join you on stage. How's that atmosphere playing with people who you already have that connection with?
So good.
It's awesome because I mean that's where our band comes from because we're best friends, right? Mm-hmm. So it's fun. Like we have a lot of fun. Yeah.
So much.
And
I love it.
Even more
we
fun.
We love Dove and Melissa.
Yeah.
I'm so because Dove he's going to Berkeley, so he has to leave at the end of the year. But we're just cherishing our time together.
Yeah, and it's even more fun to have like more people play with us.
Yeah,
awesome.
It's just like you can like look at each other and laugh and like just have a good time. It feels so good. Yeah. The more the merrier.
Yeah, now I know you two met in choir. I was a choir boy back in my day. That type of environment, how do you think it helps you not only musically but like learn about putting together songs and all that?
Well, I think that it, for me, it really helped me learn how to collaborate with other people my age and how to, like, I mean, we also did the Nutcracker, so it really helped with, like, just going up and performing because we would have to do, like, two shows a day for, like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and so you just kind of have to, like, do it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I've done so many performances with choir.
Our choir was, like, it was a tough choir.
It was pretty,
like,
strict, yeah.
We considered one of the, you know, better youth choirs in Toronto. So it also, like, I feel like it taught us to really work hard. And I feel like also, I mean, like, I love, like, harmonies and stuff. And I feel like a lot of that probably just comes from choir, like, you know, like, the overlapping of everything. So, yeah.
I saw on the web the music video for Annie, which I know you guys played at the show as well. That's a really powerful song. Especially, you know, given its chorus, where did the inspiration for that song for you come from?
It came from, like, a general feeling of, like, not feeling, you know, good enough in your skin. Because, like, I feel like a lot of, like, in this day and age, a lot of people, especially young girls, and a lot of young boys too, and just people that don't identify as girls or boys too, they feel like they have to fit this certain standard of what a beautiful, good-looking person is, which is so stupid because everybody is beautiful, everybody is good-looking, and it's like, Annie really stems from that anger of feeling like just not belonging and not being right in your body.
What she said.
Yeah.
What, you know, what's that conversation like among young people today in terms of, you know, what is acceptable? You know, we're in sort of a interesting cultural climb right now.
Yeah, things are very different right now from what they were, like, I mean, I wasn't around, well, I was, but not really, like, 10 years ago. But I feel like we're slowly getting more accepting of different body types, but there's still that thing where it's like, where if you're not this, this, and this, then you're not beautiful. Because I feel like still a lot in media, people that are very skinny are...
And then people that are curvy, like, and that's it.
And then especially people that are light-skinned are very, very, like, you know, praised in media. When there are so many, like, amazing, beautiful people that maybe aren't any of those things.
How do you guys, when you guys write your songs, how do you find you write? Are you always writing together? Does one of you do the lyrics?
Well, we always finish the song together. I think that's a really important part. Some of them we do start together. We sit down, like, okay, let's write a song. But often one of us will come with an idea for, like, a verse or a chorus or some chords, and then we just build on that.
Yeah. And it's easier to, like, write together, I find, because we can bounce ideas off of each other. But even if one of us has, like, kind of had, like, maybe already formed a song and has, like, a song already, like, when it comes to the band or to the other person, it changes
so much. Yeah, we tweak it, you know, we add harmony, so...
Mm-hmm.
It's still, like every
all
song
of our songs
is,
are us together.
Yeah, super collaborative, which is awesome.
Now, in addition to already playing at the Horseshoe, you won, I think, 2 awards last year. Was it the Young Songwriters Award and...
Young Performers Award,
yeah. Talk about the experience of having that bestowed upon you.
Wait, which one?
Both of them. Well, the first one was the Toronto Independent Music Awards.
It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. I was barely... It was so crazy.
Yeah.
We didn't think we were...
It's weird because the Toronto Independent Music Awards, they had a bunch of performances, and then they just did all the awards at once at the very end.
Yeah.
So we fell asleep.
Not
and
because
then,
the performances were bad.
No, the performances were great.
We were
it was
so
just,
tired.
We were super tired. I think it was like a school night or something.
Yeah, it was
and,
like a Tuesday.
So we fell asleep. And then our parents woke us up to be like, oh, they're announcing your award. And then we, like, go downstairs, and then they're like, Moscow Permit. We're like, what? Oh! And that was a shocker.
And then the one in the CFMAs, like, the Canadian Folk Music Award, we 100%, like, all the people that we were up against and for the awards were so talented, so good. And so we honestly did not think that we were going to win. But you, right before we sat down to, like, go do this award ceremony, you were like, oh, we need to write something so we're not unprepared. And I'm like, don't get our hopes up, Bridget. But we wrote it out.
We wrote it on, like, a piece of, like, I don't know, like, a random scrap piece of paper while we were sitting
some
waiting
point
for the awards to be announced. And then we just got up and we were like, because we were not expecting that.
We were,
amazing.
We were, like, so in shock. There's a video of, like, Bridget's grandpa taking a video of, like, of the award ceremony, and it's like, Moscow apartment, and he's like, what, oh my god.
Yeah, he's like, oh my god, so not even my grandpa expected it. So.
Does that, with that award, and then, you know, getting out there and showing your music, and getting your album, is there a certain amount of pressure that comes with winning something like that? How do you think about that?
I'd say there's pressure.
There's a lot, like, I feel like even it's such an honor to win that type of award, but, like, sometimes I feel like that kind of, as Kim says a lot, like, imposter syndrome, like, we don't deserve it, or what we're doing isn't good enough. And so it's like, it's, I don't know, sometimes when we go up and perform, we're really nervous because we're like, everyone has only read about us. They see that we've won, like, 2 awards, and we don't want their expectations to be too high.
Yeah, so there's definitely a pressure and, like, a kind of imposter syndrome thing going on.
When does pressure, how do you balance the sort of the good pressure and stress with the unwanted pressure and stress whenever you're performing or writing?
You know what? It's taken a lot of practice and figuring it out. Like, I remember, I mean, I've been playing, like, on my own for a lot longer than Pascal has, so she, like, I don't know how she got so good so fast. Like,
It's choir.
Yeah, but like, still. We were really nervous at the beginning, and I think it's just, we just have played, we're really, really lucky. We've gotten to play so many shows, and I think we just learn to, like, have fun and just relax before the show and be like, you know what, as long as we do our best, that's what matters. So
yeah. You can't let yourself get in front of yourself.
Yeah, like, we just don't really think about the show until we, like, after.
Yeah, we just kind of have to, like, be like, hey, this is fun, do it, and then after be nervous.
Yeah, yeah, we save it for after, because then it's not going to affect anything.
Brain exercises.
The process of putting the album together and making that work hard. What kind of process was like that? Was that like for you, both artistically and also just learning the business side of the industry?
Yeah. Initially, we weren't even planning on releasing an album because we started recording in My mom's here. March, April.
Recording.
Yeah.
March.
Yeah. We had only officially been a band for maybe a month and a half.
Yeah. Crazy.
We had only been playing with each other for like 3 or 4 months, and
that's why there's such a difference between each song on the album.
Yeah,
I feel.
Because they're all like very like
spaced out.
Yeah,
and we all we change very quickly. Our music changes because we're adolescents and we change very quickly.
Yeah, definitely. So it started as we were just planning on recording some demos with my dad. And then
at Ryerson.
Yeah, at the Ryerson Studios. And then we were really lucky because Samantha Martin got interested in us, and she was like, hey.
From the Summer Folk Developing Artists Program.
Yeah, and she was just, so she helped us produce an extra 2 songs. So, like, the creative process was very odd. Yeah?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So the process, I feel like, was not like a normal, like, okay, let's get the funding together and then make an album. It was just kind of like everything just kind of fell into place.
We got the funding halfway through recording the album.
Yeah, so that was fun. And the business stuff, I mean, Samantha Martin taught us a lot, but also we have amazing parents.
Yeah.
Who just kind of, started figuring it out. Because, I mean, we're 15. I wouldn't say I know a lot about business or anything.
Organically.
Yeah.
Just come out of the womb just knowing.
Yeah, just being like, this is how you raise money.
This is how you set up a big
market. Like, yeah, so we've just had a lot of help from adults with that part, too.
Did you enjoy the process overall? And are you pleased with the end product?
Yes.
Yeah. Really.
It's funny because I feel like even now our music has changed a lot from the songs on the album, but like I'm still really proud of it because like you know that was our early stuff and. Yeah, no, it's like, amazing.
It's cool that we got, like, what we started doing, like, in the beginning of our, you know, career. Like, we got it recorded, so now we can look back and be like, that's so cool that we kind of just evolved. But that's still, like, just as good, you know?
Yeah, no, totally.
Yeah.
And for me, I mean, I genuinely really love recording. Like, performing is great, but recording is just,
amazing.
Like, it's amazing. Because I want to be a producer when I'm older. So it's really fun to just go into the studio and have, like, these people, like, take our song and then just, like, make it something else. Or, like, help us make it something else. It's amazing.
Yeah.
How different did you find it sounded, you know, playing it live versus when you first recorded it or getting all the studio treatment, if you will?
I'd say very different for some of the songs.
It's, like, some of the songs, like, that were more acoustic sounded more like when we performed them, like The Things You Do, If You Please, stuff like that. But with Annie, we didn't have a backing band. Well, Annie and Caroline, we didn't have a backing band. Like, we had no drummer, bass player. So it sounds really, like, different.
Yeah.
But
like,
also so cool.
Caroline ended up having some country vibe.
Yeah,
which
we never expected.
We never expected, because, like,
but we like it.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. But we didn't sit down, like, let's write a country or country-ish song. It just kind of happened, so that was really cool.
Yeah.
You're going to be playing some more shows in this city over the next couple months. Do you think you'll be going on, like, a larger tour maybe in the summer or in the future?
Well, over March break, we're doing just a really mini tour. We're heading out east. We're going to
Halifax
and then taking the train back to Toronto and playing a bunch
of
shows.
We're going to release our show dates for that really soon.
Yeah, so we're really excited for that. I would love to tour over the summer, even if it was just for a bit.
We're trying to book a few things, but it's pretty low-key right now.
Yeah. We can't do stuff in the school year as much because we're both high school students, but, you know. Yeah, figure it out.
What are your high school friends say of all that's happened to you?
They make fun of me a lot.
I'm going to
be honest. No, like, in a nice way. They're like, oh my god, are you the girl from Moscow?
Oh yeah,
that
happens a lot. Like, I'll be sitting and eating, and then, like, my friends will come in and be like, the girl from Moscow apartment is eating in my
Sometimes our friends will just refer to us as Moscow and apartment.
Yeah, I'm apartment because I'm tall, and you're in Moscow because...
I just decided I wanted to be
Moscow. She's Moscow because she has red hair.
Oh, okay, that's new. But yeah, our friends are really, they're really chill about it.
Yeah, they come out to our shows, and they're really nice.
Yeah, and I, you know, Dove and Melissa, they play with us now, so...
They're our friends.
Yeah.
Love them.
So that's cool.
I heard that the band name came from you. Was it something in the classifieds that said Moscow apartment?
Oh, it was in a photography book.
Photography book. Okay.
There was this cool picture of this like old man in front of an apartment building, and I guess he's like a famous photographer. I have a photography book. I should probably look it up. Yeah.
And get his name.
Actually, get his name. And but it was just like blah blah blah, like some famous photographer in front of his Moscow apartment. And it's a cool picture. So.
There's a lot of bands named after cities or places. What is your favorite city in the world?
Bridget gets so... She has to have a thing.
I mean, I wouldn't know.
Mine's probably Toronto, but I'm kind of torn with Toronto.
Yeah, see, I love Toronto, but I also kind of think Toronto's kind of lame. I'm going to be honest. Like,
you can't say
I love
that, Bridget.
That the city's kind of sucky?
It's sucky because not everything is 19 plus. If we were 19, I think we'd think it's a lot better.
You know what? I can say that. I love Toronto. Definitely not my favorite city. I don't know. I like Vancouver.
New York is really cool.
New York City.
I love Barcelona. Barcelona, I really loved Barcelona.
We've both been really lucky and been able to travel a lot, so that's been cool.
Yeah.
I could not tell you.
I've always wanted to live in France. I don't know. I speak French. Montreal's cool.
I've never been to Montreal, but we're going over March break, and I'm so excited.
Yeah.
It looks like such an amazing
city.
Looks
like, it's so cool. All the cool people I follow on Instagram that wear berets live there.
Yeah. So, I don't know. We like a lot of cities.
Is there one city that you would really love to play a show in that you haven't yet?
New York.
New York City would be amazing.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. Girlpool just played in New York, like on the 8th? Yeah, them in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, New York would be a really cool city to play in.
New York.
Would you say that you have a favorite song off of the album that you really like?
I think they're all really, I love them all, but Annie just really, like, speaks to me personally.
Yeah, I kind of agree, but also, you can't ask me to choose, man.
Yeah, like, we wrote them.
Yeah, they're like,
they're all just
they're
so
like
different.
Our little babies.
It's our five little babies.
Yeah, so, but I mean, I think Annie is, like, a really important, like, because that's, like, a very political song.
Yeah, I like the message of Annie.
Yeah. So, I guess I'd go with that one just because of that.
And do you think you'll have the second album out anytime soon?
Well, we just recorded two demos, and we're hoping to get funding and stuff, so hopefully there will be one out at some point, like, later this year.
Yeah,
but I mean,
we really
knows?
We'll probably have a few singles coming out.
Yeah,
yeah,
we'll see.
We're trying. Album is the dream. That's what we're going for.
Yeah, they cost a lot of money and also take a lot of time. So we'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well, Virginie Pascal, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Once again, that was my conversation with Bridget Fry and Pascal Padilla, who make up the great feminist indie folk duo Moscow Apartment. You can catch them this Friday night at the Dakota with Georgia Harmer, starting at 6:30 to 9 p.m. They're playing Friday, March 9th, as part of the Gain Music Festival at the Red Brick Cafe in Guelph, Ontario. And on March 18th, they're again playing with Georgia Harmer at the Black Sheep Inn in Wakefield, Quebec. You can go to moscowapartment.ca for their shows. Also, Dennis Lee's book is Good Night, Good Night. That's it for the show today. Thanks to Dennis Lee, thanks to Bridget Fry and Pascal Padilla. We're going to take you out with Moscow Apartment's single Annie. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you guys will tune in on Friday. See you next time. Bye for now.
Where's my body? Where'd you hide me?